Latter-day Saints Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2008 Youth Education Conference held in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
This is wonderful. My name's Earl Taylor. My topic today is honest and wise men should be sought for diligently. Do you have that on your list? Do you know that that's in quotes? Meaning what? Meaning somebody said that. Who said that? Do you know? Real loud. That's in the Doctrine and Covenants. So who said it? The Lord said it. This is a revelation given to Joseph Smith in the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where the Lord talks about the Constitution that He established by the hands of wise men. And then His counsel to us through the prophet Joseph was to seek for honest and wise men to represent us in public office. Do we have a challenge with that? Have you noticed? We have a challenge with that. Now I'm going to tell you of another challenge that's related to that. Some of you may have heard of the prophecy of Joseph Smith about what will happen to the Constitution. Have you heard of that? He said that as the nation progresses, basically the people will lose confidence in the Constitution, even to the point of the Constitution being on the very verge of destruction. That's pretty ominous, isn't it? What does that mean, the very verge of destruction? You think we're there yet? Well, if you really study the document and you study all the aspects of the document, what the founders said to do and what we're now doing, guess what? You have to conclude, if this isn't hanging by a thread, it's hanging by two threads. Because almost every precious principle in that document is being violated today. And of course, you don't know that unless you study it. But that was the counsel of the Lord. You've got to elect wise and good people. There's another name we call those kind of people that are wise and good. What would that be? Statesmen. That's true, statesmen. So we're going to talk today about how we as young people, as teenagers for the most part, can prepare to become statesmen. I want to tell you a little story. I was driving from Phoenix to Tucson. I was involved in a political campaign a few years ago, and I was driving down to Tucson for a political rally of some kind, and I got a phone call from a student. He says, I'm a student at ASU, Arizona State University, there in Tempe, which is next to Phoenix. He said, I understand you're going to Tucson. I said, yes. He says, can I hitch a ride with you? I said, sure. So that made two of us, and that was great. And so as I picked him up, here's a young student, 1 year from graduating from university with a degree in political science. And I said to him, we had about an hour and a half to converse, and I said to him, so what do you want to do after you graduate from college? And he said to me, I want to go into politics. I don't know what that says to you. Oh, you want to go into politics, do you? What does that mean? Oh, he says, I intend just as soon as possible to get well known so I can run for public office. And I said to myself as I looked over to him, you don't know much at all. You're just starting out in life. And you want to run for public office? And then I thought to myself, you know, the founding fathers would have some advice for this young man. And so we had a great time as we talked, and I hopefully taught him some things, because the founders had a whole different way to prepare for public office rather than going to school and getting a degree in political science. And Those of you who've studied some of our principles will recognize this next point I want to make. Thomas Jefferson talked about aristocracies. And he talked about two kinds of aristocracies. Does anyone here know what I'm talking about yet? If you've studied the third of the 28 principles, the third one, it talks about aristocracies. What's an aristocracy? Quickly, anybody? Aristocracy? Okay, kind of the ruling bodies, right? And Jefferson said there's an artificial aristocracy based on what? What would that be based on? That's right. Money, social status, maybe by birth, right? Have you heard of those kind of aristocracies? Well, I was born into this aristocratic family, so I'm next in line to become king. So that's artificial, just by birth. Doesn't measure your intelligence, doesn't measure how much good you've done to this point, whether you've earned it or not. You're just born into it. That's artificial. And, of course, a lot of governments are based on that. But Jefferson comes along and he says there's another kind of aristocracy that he called the natural aristocracy. And that's an aristocracy based on what? Talents and ability that you have proven. And he said our system should be such that what we do is recognize people out there who have developed their talents, who have shown in their public life that they are moral, that they have abilities to organize and get things done, and those are the kind of people we need to choose and put into our public offices. So what is that? What would that tell you about a kid coming right out of college? You're not ready yet, young man. So we kind of talked a little bit. And I was raised on a farm, and one of the things we did on the farm was milk cows. Anybody milk cows in here still? Do you? Well, congratulations. Look how many people we have to provide milk for here. And of course, when you milk a cow, whether you do it by hand or by machine, you know, we did it by hand all the time, and we'd pour it into gallon bottles and put it in the refrigerator. And overnight, what would happen? The cream would rise to the top. And then what would you do? Well, you don't know, I guess. What do? You skim off the cream. For what? Oh, that is the nice stuff. You make butter. Sour cream butter is the best, by the way. Anyways, you make butter. You make lots of different things. Cream, that's the rich. That's the best part of the milk. I say that to say this. This is what a natural aristocracy does. Jefferson says, you let people rise to the top based on their own richness of talents and abilities and what they do in their private life. Then he said, as I said before, you develop a system whereby you skim the very best off the top, those that have risen up naturally. You skim off the top, and those are the people you put into your offices of power and trust. What do you think? That's a great system. So a man or a woman has been in business or raised a wonderful family and has been active maybe in their church, in the community. In other words, a great person that has been through the fire of life. One who has paid the taxes that have been thrust upon them, or has had to obey laws, all these regulatory laws in building a business. They go into the legislature and they're thinking, what? Boy, I've got to reduce taxes. I don't want my children to go through what I went through. And they've suffered under some of these regulatory laws. Those are the best people you want to help keep the government in its proper role. Would you agree with that? Isn't that a great system? That's natural aristocracy. Jefferson had it right. He says that's the kind of system we have to have. Well, we talk about becoming statesmen. And in my opinion, we should think about becoming statesmen the very way that Franklin, Jefferson, and Washington became statesmen, became great statesmen. Do you think they woke up one morning as a young teenager and said, "I'm going to become a great statesman"? I don't think so. What did they do? Boy, they did a number of things that prepared them. I got a quote here from Elder Dallin Oaks. He gave a great speech one time at BYU. Actually, it was in 02, and he called it timing. You know, sometimes people get worried about timing in their lives. And, well, I have to be married by this time. I have to be a college graduate by this time. And they have all their life planned out. And here's what he said. Do not rely on planning every event of your life, even every important event. Stand ready to accept the Lord's planning and the agency of others in matters that inevitably affect you. Plan, of course, but fix your planning on personal commitments that will carry you through no matter what happens. What's he saying here? You just be the best kind of person you can be. You do what's expected of you to do as a teenager, as a family member, as a school student, as a member of the church, as a priesthood holder, as a young woman, as a Boy Scout. Whatever you're involved in, whatever commitments you have, you learn to do them the very best. And leave the timing of other goals to the Lord. Because the Lord, through His prophets and through His appointed leaders, will recognize you and will tap you and say, "It's your turn to serve." Isn't that great? That's what Elder Oaks is talking about. So with that, I want to tell you another story. I serve as the principal of a charter high school in Mesa. We have about 400 students. And they're great young people. But every once in a while, especially when you have 400 students together, somebody does something kind of dumb. And it wasn't long ago. This happens two or three times a year, not often. And a teacher sends me a student. And in this case, he was a sophomore. He was 10th grade, so that means he was about what age? About 15, maybe? Okay. Kind of right in there, right? At great age. And so we visited, and the teacher had written a little note. So-and-so was disturbing the class and was disrespectful to me, the teacher. Well, we take that stuff seriously. So here he is in my office, and we're visiting, and I said, "Tell me about it." So he tells me about it, and I could kind of tell that, you know, he chose to be pretty disrespectful, and we don't stand for that stuff at our school. And so I hear his story, and then I say to him, "Where do you learn to be good?" Looks at me like, "Nobody's asked me that before. Where do you learn to be good?" And he said, "Well, at home." "Okay, that's great. Any place else?" He says, "Well, at church." And I said, "What church did you go to?" All of the 400 we have are not LDS. We don't ask, and I presume probably about 60% are, but we have a good smattering of other faiths. I said, "What church did you go to?" He said, "The Mormon church." I said, "I'm somewhat familiar with the Mormon church. And you're 15. Actually, I was serving as bishop at that time. Not his bishop. And I said, "You're 15. He said, "Yes." I said, "That means you're a running priesthood holder." He said, "Yes." "You're a teacher." "Yes." "You're probably also Boy Scout." "Yes." Actually, I should say there were two young men in my office, two of them, and they were both 15, and they both went to the same ward, I found out, and of course, they're both Boy Scouts. I said, "What rank are you?" One of them said, "I've almost got my eagle." And the other one said, well, I'm a Star Scout. And I said, well, that's interesting. Do you know the Scout Oath and the Scout Law? And he said, yeah. And I said, I want you to repeat them for me. Now, when I have young people come in my office, I have the door. Usually the door is always open, right? And once in a while, some other young people walk by because there's classrooms there. So these young men, I say, I want you to repeat the Scout Law for me. So they're sitting there across from my desk, and both of them, they look at me like, you really want me to repeat the Scout Law? Yeah. So they go like this, and they say, a scout is... I said, wait a minute. You don't do it like that. They look at their hand. Oh. A scout... Wait a minute. You don't do it like that either. Is that how you do it at Scouts? A scout... Wait a minute. You don't do it like that either. They said, you mean we have to stand up? I said, well, isn't that the way you repeat it? You don't repeat it sitting down. Anyway, I got these two young men, 15 years old, standing up in front of my desk like this, repeating the Scout Law. And they know it. A scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, and you know it. And about halfway through, some other students walk by my door, and they look in. And here they see these two young men. And of course, these young guys, they're looking out there like, well, I hope nobody sees me. Anyway, I do that to hopefully emphasize a lesson, because after they repeat the Scout Law and the Scout Oath, and I've done this to girls also who are young women and had them repeat the seven values, right? You know the seven values, right? Okay. See, that gives me a basis to talk with them about. I say, okay, a scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient. Were you obedient in class just now? No. You've taken an oath to be obedient. Or in the case of the scout oath, on my honor, I will do my best. Were you doing your best? No. One young man, I said, you're 15, you're a teacher. Did you go to church last Sunday? Yeah. Did you do your priesthood duty? Yeah. You prepare the sacrament? Yeah. You prepare the sacrament on Sunday, and the next day, it was a Monday, you come here and act like this? I had one young person say, well, I never thought about it like that before. I said, you mean scout laws and priesthood duties only apply on Sundays and mutual nights? See, this is kind of what we need to start thinking, young people. The commitments that we've made, are we keeping them? I like to ask, and I'll ask you, young people, one question. I can tell something about you by asking you this question. Here it is. What does your room look like right now? At home. Right now. That tells a whole lot about a young person. Because I know your mother's asked you to clean it several times, right? You say, well, that's really not me. That's my little brother. Well, whatever. So that's what you're thinking, right? Or my little sister. See, that really reflects you. Your property reflects you. The way you're doing things right now reflects you. Are you pleased with it? Anyway, what I want to do, and I've done this with Catholic boys and with Baptist boys. It seems to be the boys mostly in my office. I try to find out what kind of commitments they have made and see if I can help them apply those commitments at school. And it's really helped. Well, I want to talk for just a minute here about Jefferson, Franklin, and Washington. We have these three books here, the real Jefferson, the real Washington, the real Franklin. The reason we call them the real is because this tells their story in their own words. There's a lot of people who write these books about these men that, from certain perspectives, but this is their real story. And in my opinion, if you learn about these great founding fathers, it will provide a pathway for you to become as they were, great statesmen, great citizens. So I thought you might be interested in some of the things they did as teenagers to prepare them, because they didn't think about becoming great statesmen as teenagers. They were just trying to get through their teenage years. And maybe I'll mention a few of them just very quickly. Do you know, Franklin said, one of the best things my parents did, my father, he said, did, was invite, when we would sit down at the dinner table, he would invite somebody from the community, either from the university or other person that he admired, to come and have dinner with us. He said, we learned more about what was happening in the world and different perspectives. We had great discussions around the dinner table when we had somebody come in. I don't know if you've ever had that opportunity or not. I was privileged to spend over a number of years, many times with Dr. W. Cleon Skousen, who was the founder of our organization. And once in a while, I would invite him to dinner with my family. Oh, my goodness. That was an amazing experience. And Franklin said, that's what we did in our home. Just a little hint as to how to expose yourself to great people and your children to great people. That's what Franklin said. And let me just mention a couple of other things. Did you know that when Franklin was in England, he got the nickname of Water American? They called him Water American. What are you calling me Water American for? Because you don't drink. Listen to this. He says, in England, he refused to drink beer like everyone else. As a result, he was much stronger and able to do more work than those who drank strong beer. In other words, Franklin, at his in the culture at his time, kept what? A certain word of wisdom. See, this is before the prophet Joseph Smith. And amazing. In other words, he lived what he thought. And he had the courage and the discipline when everybody else was breaking it. Young people, you want to become a great statesman, you be true to what you know is right in the word of wisdom. Will you do that? No matter what anybody else is doing around you. Here's another one. Do you owe any money to anybody? Or does anybody owe you any money? Okay. Here's Franklin. He says, well, there was a situation where someone owed him money and the person couldn't repay him. What would you do? First of all, you kind of get angry a little bit. What I do that for? You know what Franklin did? This is what he said. Go and do something of equal value for someone else. And ask them to do the same for someone else. He said, this way, much more good will be done with a little bit of money. Do you understand that? Amazing. In other words, you take a bad situation and you make it better. And you make friends. You don't make somebody angry at you. Here's another thing about Franklin. What was the best way Franklin had to respond to other people's criticism? You ever been criticized? How do you respond? You know what Franklin did? Ignored it. Can you ignore criticism? Usually our tendency is to what? Want to strike back? Not Franklin. It developed him into one of the greatest diplomats America has ever seen. And there was another interesting thing about Franklin here. He always avoided... You could not get into an argument with Benjamin Franklin. You been in an argument lately? Nobody's been in an argument lately? Oh, you have? Usually with a family member at your age? You could not bait Franklin into an argument. You know that? Why? Because he would hear somebody's position, and his response would not include one of those definite words, like certainly, or like, well, any nitwit knows that's not true, or, you know, some real definite biting retort. He wouldn't do that. You know what he would say? Well, I understand your position. It would seem to me like, or have you thought about it from this perspective? And that's how Franklin became our nation's greatest diplomat. Nobody could get him into an argument. Would you practice that at home, young people? So this will help you become great statesmen. Practice avoiding all arguments. Jefferson, if I can find his little... He said, and Jefferson wouldn't argue either. It's kind of interesting. Most of these statesmen, they don't like arguing, and they didn't. But Jefferson said, well, somebody wants to challenge me. I will either not reply at all, or, he said, I will reply in agreement with them, even though I don't agree with them. That makes sense. And then... I will work from their position and show how their thinking is fallacious, just a little bit, and lead them back to agreeing with me. I'm telling you what, that's a talent. That's a talent you can practice in your family. Isn't it wonderful the Lord blesses us with families? These are great places to learn these things. Will you become known as the peacemaker of your family? You know you can become that. By some of these techniques. Anyway, I want to tell you a little story here about Thomas Jefferson as we think about this great man. One of the things he refused to argue about, refused to hardly discuss, was his religion. That was a very personal thing to Thomas Jefferson. And maybe you've heard most people today say Jefferson was what, religious-wise? An atheist. You've heard that, right? Do you know why they say that? What? Wouldn't talk back, okay. He very seldom expressed his religious views, and he never joined a church. Now, you got to understand what was happening at that time. This was in the... late 1700s, even early 1800s. You know something about the religious fervor in the early 1800s, don't you? What was happening? This was an era, particularly up in New England, but also in Virginia with Jefferson, where there was a lot of religious... What's the word? What is it? Religious excitement. Isn't that what Joseph Smith says in his stories? A lot of religious excitement. This was a very Calvinistic time when... If you didn't join a church, it was said of you by other preachers who wanted you to join their church, you are damned to hell. Wow. When Jefferson's running for president in 1800 and he hasn't attached himself to any church, guess who were some of his foremost opponents in his presidency? From what I've told you, what would you say? Preachers, clergymen. Oh, they were very vitriolic against Jefferson. How can we have a president of the United States who isn't saved? Who isn't religious? He hasn't joined a church, any church. So he's, as I said... And the clergymen were some of his most vocal opponents. This was really sad. Let me read to you, and I'm reading out of the real Thomas Jefferson. Let me read to you what Thomas Jefferson felt about Christianity. He said, "My views of the Christian religion are the result of life and inquiry and reflection, and very different from that anti-Christian system imputed to me by those who know nothing of my opinions." In other words, he knew that they were criticizing him for not being saved or not believing. He said, "They know nothing about me." He says, "To the corruptions of Christianity, I am indeed opposed." And that's why he never joined a church, because he felt like, now this is before Joseph Smith, this is before the first vision, he felt like every church that existed had corrupted the doctrines of Jesus. Isn't that amazing to come to that conclusion before the first vision? He says, "To the corruptions of Christianity, I am indeed opposed, but not to the genuine precepts of Jesus himself. I am a Christian in the only sense in which he," meaning Christ, "wished anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines and not to the corrupt ones that you see today." Isn't that amazing? Then he said, "If we can have the freedom of religion continue to be guaranteed," I'm paraphrasing here to shorten it, he said, "truth will prevail over fanaticism, and the genuine doctrines of Jesus will again be restored to their original purity." Do you hear this, young people? This is Thomas Jefferson talking about the eventual restoration of the pure doctrines of Jesus. He said, "This reformation will advance with the other improvements of the human mind if you keep freedom of religion, but too late for me to witness it." See, there's a little lamenting there that he would be probably not around to enjoy it. Do you know when he said this? When he foretold that the original pure doctrines of Christ will be restored? He said that in 1820. The year of the first vision. See, Joseph Smith's and Thomas Jefferson's lives overlapped. Joseph Smith was born in 1805 when Jefferson was president of the United States. Thomas Jefferson died in 1826, 4 years before the church was organized. And I just love Thomas Jefferson. I love his feelings. I love his teachings about how to be a good person. And in my opinion, Thomas Jefferson was of the same kind of spirit as Joseph Smith. Just a little different mission. But we needed someone to lay the foundation of freedom so the gospel could be restored. Well, that's Thomas Jefferson. And I want to tell you just a little incident about Washington. See what you think of this. Washington said in his farewell address, turn to it here. This is after he had been president for 8 years. I'll paraphrase the first sentence. He says, "Don't let anybody ever tell you that you can have freedom without two things, religion and morality." He said they are indispensable supports. Do we have indispensable supports for this building? This building we're sitting in, what would they be? Would you say those beams going up there are indispensable supports? You take them out, what would happen? this whole thing would collapse. So he is saying indispensable supports for the liberty of our country are religion and morality. Oh my goodness, what does that mean? That means you cannot have freedom unless you have religion and morality. Have you heard differently today? You got people out there saying, well, I can be free, it doesn't matter. I had a young person tell me this in Lexington, Kentucky, not too long ago. I can be free, I don't have to have religion. See, the founders would say, can't do it. Then he goes on to say, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. What does that mean? Can you be a moral person without religion? You hear this once in a while today. Somebody says, oh, I don't need to belong to a church. I don't need to have an organized religion. I'm a moral person. You know what my question to them is? Whose morality do you follow? And they will say, usually what? My own. I've seen a person who claims to be a moral person do some pretty bad things. Maybe you have too. And here Washington is saying, you can't be moral without religion. I want to ask you young people, why? Why would he say that? Why does he say you can't really be moral, you can't maintain morality without religion? Who can answer that question? Yes. Excellent, excellent. There's no reason to be moral if there is no God. Good answer, yes? Wonderful. Religion sets the standard, doesn't it? And yes, sir? That's correct. This is interesting when Washington is saying, don't ever forget, you got to be religious and moral. Then he goes on and he says, and I'll just paraphrase it. He says, sometimes an educated person will claim because they have refined education, you know, a lot of degrees behind their name, PhD or whatever, that they don't need religion anymore. Be careful with that kind of thinking. Because he said, morality cannot be maintained without religion. So, we got some big challenges, young people. And as far as I'm concerned, this whole idea of building statesmen starts with being good yourself. Will you try to be that way? Anybody familiar with Ben Franklin and his quest for being good? Anybody familiar with Franklin and his quest for being good? You remember that? That's correct. He worked on 13 virtues. He called it a bold and ardent adventure. And he couldn't quite get one of them down. Every day in his book, he would have these 13 virtues like honesty and so forth listed. And every day in his book, he would evaluate himself. And he would keep a record of how he's doing. And some days he would say, well, I goofed there. Got into the argument with that person. Shouldn't have done it. I'll do better tomorrow. And he kept that up and he kept that up. And the only one he had a real problem with was pride. Because he said, as soon as you think you've overcome pride, what? You're a little prideful. This Franklin was amazing. And see if I can mention a couple of other things here. How did Franklin describe the trend in music in his day? You interested? Here's what he said. He said, those unpracticed in music tend to use tricks and loud sounds rather than really studying music and appreciating the natural pleasure arising from melody and harmony of sound. Do we have that problem today? Oh my gosh. And you know about music. See if I can bring a couple more here. Jefferson seemed to have the ability to study. Anybody know from our course how many hours Jefferson studied? For a 5-year period, he studied 12 to 14 hours a day. Hello? 12 to 14 hours a day studying. He would finish about 2 o'clock in the morning. Anybody relate to that? And he had 2 hobbies to kind of keep him going. That's a pretty rigorous schedule. And one of the things he did was play the violin. And he was good at it. He played an hour a day, practiced. He got so good that he was asked to play at the governor's palace in Williamsburg. Not too far from here, right? You've been to the governor's palace in Williamsburg? Beautiful place. And Jefferson was asked to play there once a month. And it was so nice that he was asked to play there because accompanying him on the harpsichord was a young lady by the name of Martha Wales Skelton. And they began eventually making beautiful music together. Right? They were married. And so that's one of the things he did for diversion. Do you use music as a diversion? You young statesmen, you? Do you do that? Don't overlook that talent. Some of us have a pretty latent talent for music. But the other thing he liked to do, or did, I don't know how much he liked it, he jogged 2 miles a day. He said when he finished his studies around 2 a.m. in the morning, he would choose a rock about a mile out of town. He would jog to the rock and back again before he went to bed. Do you keep yourselves physically fit like that? Says Jefferson. It's all a part of becoming a statesman in your young lives. And boy, can we learn from these people who didn't think necessarily they were going to become the statesman they became, but they qualified themselves for the Lord in His timing, as Elder Oak said, to then pluck them out like cream off of a gallon bottle and put them into offices of trust and honor. What a great example we have to become statesmen. Maybe I could mention a couple of others here. I'll mention this one that I always have fun with young people. It's Thomas Jefferson's feeling about our relationships with foreign nations. Do you remember Principle 25? Anybody have that one memorized? Peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. In other words, don't get yourself entangled with any other nation. It will be bad news if you do. When I'm talking to my teenage students at school, I try to bring it right down to their level and I say, are you entangled with anyone? Do you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend at your age? And once in a while I know those students pretty well. Once in a while I'll know somebody does. I say, what does that do when you entangle yourselves with somebody that young? What does that do? All of a sudden his problems become your problems. Have you noticed that about the United States? When we entangle ourselves with other countries, all of a sudden their problems become our problems. It's all so artificial. Jefferson says, don't do it. And so I give that to you as advice, young people. Keep yourself tangle-free. Don't entangle yourself. There will come a time, very appropriately, when you will come together with one that you love in a most sacred way in the temple, hopefully. But that's not yet. So don't entangle yourselves with another person so that his or her problems become yours. And it makes everybody else feel like, well, he doesn't like me as much as he likes her. And all of a sudden, it just gets messy. And that same concept of human relationships, Jefferson said, applies on the national level for foreign relations. What wonderful thinking. Young people, I pray that God's blessings will be with you as you grow up, as you mature, as you work in your families, as you study these concepts. and promise you that if you do, great blessings are in store, because Joseph Smith said, the time will come when the Constitution is on the very verge of destruction, when this people, talking to members of the church, will become the staff upon which the nation will lean. What does that mean? They will depend on us for answers. And it will lead the Constitution away from the very verge of destruction. You, my young friends, are the ones that are going to save this thing. I've already apologized to my students for me and my generation. I said, we blew it. I'm sorry. Now it's your turn. Will you rise to that occasion? Will you feel the fire in your bones, the message of the founding fathers of our country? I hope you do. May God bless you in that. I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.